So now we have an idea of what it looks like from Michael's perspective. Let's turn from Canada now to Australia and invite up our next speaker, who is active in the areas of copyright law and the internet. And she is famous for her work in Australia and for that around the world. Please make welcome a senior lecturer in law from the University of Queensland, the wonderful Kim Weatherly.
Oh, I'm going to give you such a hard time for that, Nat. Weatherall, people, Weatherall. Now, Michael, of course, has, as usual, brilliantly set up the background on ACTA, the really problematic aspects about ACTA, the question of transparency. What I'd like to do, because this is what I do, is drill down a little into some of the detail of the leaked text that is in front of you. And I want to talk about some of those provisions, some of the problems they raise, some of the matters of detail. On your table, there is also a paper, a longer paper, that I've written about this from an Australian perspective. I don't recommend you try to read it now. There's a nice summary table at the front, though, so that you don't have to read all of the footnotes. And then I want to talk about two responses that we might have to the ACTA process. First, how we might make arguments against ACTA itself and against some of the ACTA provisions, how we might frame such arguments. And secondly, if there is going to be an anti-counterfeiting agreement, if we are going to have something, as Michael would put it, how we might fix it, positive things that we might say we do want in such an agreement, if there is to be such an agreement. Okay, so moving to some of the problems. Now, some of these Michael has touched on, and so I won't, I'll try not to repeat too much of what he has talked about. I want to start with the internet stuff because, of course, this is the focus for negotiations here in Wellington, and this is an Internet NZ event. Now, Michael has already mentioned the internet safe harbour provisions. These start on page 27 of the text. And, of course, as Michael mentioned, there's a number of different proposals here, basically an EU/US proposal, and then a very, very different Japanese proposal reflecting their very different system. Now, of course, I don't think the basic idea of having safe harbours is a problem. It's not a bad one, but the devil is in the details, and we can make a couple of points here. Firstly, if you look at the categories of protected material, of course, it reflects the DMCA and to some extent EU law. It talks about four different types of activities. Transmission, activities that are not directed or initiated or where the material is not selected by the OSP. I think this is meant to mean caching, and this appears to be the explanation from some of the other documents. Search engine activities, so referring or linking users to an online location. And storage of information provided by a user, that is, hosting. Now, the obvious problem with this list is it's quite short, and it was written in 1998. That's over 12 years ago, because this was written for the DMCA in the United States. And having this list, having these safe harbours, does raise the question of whether you could have others. You know, if we sign up to an ACTA with these four, can we have other ones, say, for content aggregators, say, for a Google Books-type scenario? In fact, the question of having safe harbours for content aggregators has actually been discussed in the European Union. There was a specific provision in one of their directives that required this to be examined as a possibility. And although that hasn't gone anywhere at this stage, there is a question as to whether we might need more safe harbours in the future. Now, as an Australian, I can be terribly relaxed about this because actually we're already screwed. When we signed up to the FTA with the United States, we signed up to a particular note that said if we'd like to create safe harbours for similar activities, we can have consultations with the United States. So in theory, we may not be able to introduce them in any event. But for everyone else, for New Zealand, for Canada, for other countries, that's a question you want to ask. Second point is something that Michael has touched on, of course, which is The question of notice and takedown. There is a notice and takedown requirement in the US proposal. It doesn't, even on the most protective version for users, which is at the top of page 29 of the text, it doesn't seem to offer any protection in the case of where an exception like fair dealing applies. So if you are someone who's hosting material, it looks like a fair dealing exception might apply. You receive a notice, and then the user says, well, the person who put it up says, well, it's fair dealing. That doesn't seem to be covered by a system that envisages counter notices from users referring to the material being identified by mistake or misidentification. So it doesn't look like you could have a counter notice saying this is fair dealing. So not only is it notice and takedown, but there's no protection for fair dealing, it seems. A second condition, this one that Michael again has already mentioned, the question of adopting and reasonably implementing a policy to address the unauthorised storage or transmission of materials protected by copyright. Now, looking at the text, I actually think the negotiators do believe they've steered clear of mandating three strikes and that they have satisfied the people who are complaining about that problem while still requiring the ISPs to do something. The problem is this. I mean, Michael has already said the problem is that ISPs will treat it as mandatory. I think once you get to the point of drafting legislation to implement this language, a government has three choices. The government can set out in legislation what they think would be an adequate policy and require the ISPs to implement that policy. They could tell the ISPs and the right holders to negotiate a policy and maybe facilitate that with the threat of we will legislate if you don't. Or they could put this language directly into the legislation and see what happens. Effectively require the ISPs to decide what it means, adopt it, and then wait to get sued. Now, if a country adopts versions one or two of that, either they legislate or they tell people to negotiate, the starting point is three strikes, because that's all everyone's talking about at the moment, and that's what the right holders want. So that is your starting point for those negotiations. And if it's version three, if you just put this language into the legislation and let it go to court, the right holders will be in court arguing for three strikes, because that is in fact what we've seen in Australia. You may be familiar with the IINet case, where a lawsuit was brought against IINet and ISP, arguing that they were authorising infringement. Now, in that case, the safe harbours that we implemented as a result of the free trade agreement were litigated. Now, the language of our safe harbours actually reflects the footnote that Michael showed you. It requires us to adopt, the ISP to adopt and reasonably implement a policy for the termination of repeat infringements. Now, the argument raised in court was, in effect, that this required three strikes type things, warning letters, possibly choking and suspension of internet service, followed eventually by termination. The ISP, on the other hand, argued that they had a policy for termination of repeat infringers. It was, if we get ordered by a court, we will terminate. That argument actually got up before a first instance judge in Australia, before Justice Cowdroy in the judgment in February. It's on appeal at the moment. But, you know, the basic point is that if you have this language in the ACTA, whichever way it goes from there, whether it's legislation, whether it's courts, whether it's negotiation, the starting point has to be three strikes. And I think we will end up with three strikes, despite the best efforts of the negotiators in trying to avoid mandating that. There are other provisions. And there's a further provision which suggests that ISPs might be required to divulge identity of users without a court order for that. So, again, the devil is in the details of these safe harbours. There are other provisions that affect intermediaries. or other proposals. There's one provision that where the members or the parties that are contracting to this treaty agree that they all recognise a form of secondary liability. And secondary liability is where you're liable not because you're directly infringing, but because someone else is using your service to infringe and you're in some way facilitating that. So it's the claim that's brought against file-sharing software, providers, ISPs and the like. Now, the problem with this affirmation of secondary liability is, well, for the first thing, this would be the first time in an international treaty that there was any provision concerning secondary liability at all. It's just not, it's not in Berne, it's not in TRIPS, there's no requirement in international law to recognise secondary liability. So when they tell you that ACT is not about substantive IP law and that provision's in there, it's simply not true. The second problem with the provision, if you look at it, is it seeks to define what secondary liability means. And it uses a kind of ham-fisted version of US case law, tried to, you know, put into two lines or two sentences. Now, even the US lawyers are saying it's not accurate as a reflection of US law. And let me tell you, in Australia, we've again had experience with this sort of problem. If you try to codify secondary liability, if you try to define it, it leads to decades of uncertainty about exactly what the impact of the attempted codification is on the law. In 1999, Australia attempted to codify secondary liability, list factors that had to be taken into account. What followed was 10 years of litigation where in every case people would argue that the legislation had expanded secondary liability. And incredible uncertainty. Again, so if this gets into the treaty, you're all going to have the Australian experience. A lot of uncertainty about the degree of liability. The other provision, proposal affecting intermediaries is an idea of having injunctions against intermediaries where their services are being used to infringe copyright. Now, these injunctions don't look like they would be conditioned on the intermediary itself being liable for infringing or authorising infringement. So it would be a case of proving that some third party was infringing and then having an order of the court against the intermediary requiring them to take action. And if you don't comply with the court order, of course, contempt and all sorts of serious consequences can follow. Now, I find this a little bit scary. It's an EU proposal. It's not clear whether it has support from other countries. And I think it's scary because it looks like a backdoor way to get ISPs to take action against infringing users, even if there's no three-strike system. So you can imagine rights holders going to court, identifying a series of users who were infringing online, and asking for an injunction against the ISP to take action against those users. I don't know whether this would happen, but in the absence of a fully developed three-strike-style system, I can imagine rights holders seeking to use the injunction power that way. So, you know, and that argument is put in more detail in the paper. So there's some really, really concerning stuff when it comes to the internet material. What else? Well, there is the anti-circumvention provisions. Michael mentioned that different countries will have different concerns. I can't get excited about this. I'm really sorry. Because Australia has already signed up to the most ludicrously restrictive TPM regime that you can imagine via a sort of a DMCA via FTA process. So this looks positively generous to me. Yeah, it lets you have exceptions, after all, which we don't get to have. But it is all the things you'd expect. A prohibition on unauthorised circumvention of technological protection measures and a prohibition on circulation of devices. So you can't have the old Australian system of only banning circulation of devices on the US proposal. It has a criminal offence for willful conduct, that is, knowingly circumventing a TPM would be a criminal act. It does allow exceptions, as I say. That's a good thing. The good news here is there seems to be considerable disagreement over these provisions. Japan in particular is asking a lot of questions and doesn't seem to be thrilled about the idea of having a prohibition on circumvention of access controls. So if something is controlling access but not necessarily controlling a copyright right, Japan is less certain about whether that should be included. So that is good news, I guess, in the sense that there's disagreement. But as Michael has pointed out, these are definitely substantive provisions, definitely concerning for countries, unlike Australia, who haven't signed up to a USFTA. And there's a series of other problematic proposals that I want to point to. Statutory damages. Again, Michael has mentioned these. Where the statutory damages is where the legislation fixes a particular amount as being the damage that can be recovered for an infringement. So under the US system, a rights holder can elect statutory damages, and those damages can range from $500 per work infringed to, in the case of willful infringement, up to $150,000 per work infringed. Now, there's a number of problems with this. One is that in a digital context, these damages mount very, very quickly, because quite frequently in a digital context, there will be multiple works being infringed, if any are. You know, if you're file sharing, you might have 100, 1,000 songs in your shared folder. The other problem is that it does become a real threat to individuals. Michael has mentioned the number of file sharers who've been threatened with a lawsuit. These threats, of course, have come out in the few cases that have actually gone all the way to a court decision in the US, the Jamie Thomas case being a particularly famous one. In that case, a woman who had shared or was proved to have shared 20 songs was hit with a damages bill of $1.92 million. So commercial level, serious commercial counterfeit type level damages being raised against an individual. And the threat of that is what causes people to settle. There's the expansion of criminal liability. Michael has mentioned the expansion to what are, in effect, personal and private acts. So significant infringements with no direct or indirect motivation of financial gain, or willful infringement for commercial advantage or private financial gain. Again, Australia signed up to significant expansions of our criminal law in the FTA, but this goes even beyond ours. The mention of private financial gain, which seems to suggest, or might suggest at least on one interpretation, that if you copy a DVD to avoid paying for another copy, say your two-year-old destroys the first one, made a copy as a backup, that is private financial gain. You are avoiding the cost of paying for another one. So that potentially is a very significant expansion. And the new camcording in cinemas offence, which it appears no one can agree on. We had a debate about this sort of provision back in 2006 in Australia. We had significant expansions of our criminal provisions in 2006, all on this sort of enforcement agenda argument. The government completely rewrote our criminal provisions, introduced a series of strict liability offences to make them easier to prosecute. And we had a very, very big fight to protect non-commercial private acts that people might do without realising they were criminal. And we succeeded, for the most part, in Australia in removing the worst of those offences, the ones that might impact on private individuals. But looking at this, ACTA could bring some of that back in, because the camcording proposal at the moment doesn't require that you distribute the copy that you make, doesn't require that it be for a commercial purpose, doesn't require any proof of commercial harm. It's the simple act of making a film of a film. It looks like if you were like filming your friend being silly in the cinema and you happen to capture some of the film in the background, like it just doesn't have any exceptions. From a slightly less sort of personal or individual consumer perspective, you should also note that there's a proposal to extend criminal provisions to ordinary trademark infringement. So at the moment, TRIPS requires that we make criminal counterfeiting. Right? If you're copying like an identical mark and applying it to the registered goods, so you're, you know, you're making fake Louis Vuitton handbags, that can be a criminal act. But if you adopt a trademark that happens to be a bit too close to someone else's, you know, you could get sued civilly, but you're not going to be engaging in criminal behaviour. Well, that would change under one of the proposals in ACTA. And the concern about this is it starts to capture legitimate business activities. Ordinary business doing ordinary things, sailing a little bit too close to the wind, and suddenly you're threatened with criminal action, not just being sued in a civil court. And the chilling effects of that kind of thing are potentially extraordinary. There's significant extensions to the customs provisions. At the moment, TRIPS requires, in essence, that we have procedures for rights holders to make notice, to give notices to customs, to get goods seized at the borders, if it's copyright or trademark counterfeiting. The proposals in ACTA would extend these seizures potentially to patent and to ordinary trademark infringement, so not just counterfeiting. It would also extend the provisions not just when goods are imported, but also when they're being exported or transshipped goods. Now, transshipped goods are where you've got goods that are made in one country, country A, and they're going to country B, but, you know, in the process, they end up passing through a port in country C. Country C is the transshipment country. So it's the goods are not made in country C, they're not being destined for the market of country C, but they just happen to be in the port there. Now, if the full proposals of ACTA come through, goods could be seized in transshipment. Now, Europe already has provisions like this, and they have them for patent. And what it's led to is the seizure of generic pharmaceuticals. India has had a major dispute over the last couple of years with Europe over the seizure of these generic pharmaceuticals that are covered by a patent in the EU, but perhaps not in the destination country. So the extension to transshipment does have the potential to impact on the generics market and on access to medicines, I'm sorry to say. Finally, there's this unqualified right to an injunction. Again, Michael has mentioned this, and Knowledge Ecology International's paper on this is it's a fascinating read. They've gone through and they've found a series of situations where the US has qualified patent rights. So, for example, the US grants patents for methods of surgery or methods of medical treatment, but they didn't want doctors to end up having to pay damages for using, say, a medical treatment to save someone's life, infringing a patent. And so you can't get damages or other remedies if against such a doctor. The patent is still valid and it may be used, I don't know how it's used, but in any event, it can't be asserted against the doctor. And you certainly can't get an injunction against a doctor. Now, the unqualified right to an injunction that we see in ACTA, KEI believe, and I think they're probably right, could mean that those sorts of accommodations aren't allowed anymore. To give another example, something that's been discussed but not actually implemented that I know of, let's say that someone has a patent relevant to some technical standard. Some patent you need, say, to make mobile phones, and they didn't disclose it when this standard was being approved, then they try to cash in. Now, government might decide that's wrong and put in their legislation a provision that limits the remedies to, say, a reasonable royalty, so you can't get an injunction. The unqualified right to an injunction in ACTA might stand in the way, and TRIPS has a limitation that would prevent it standing in the way that probably should be included also in ACTA. So that's some of the detail. I mean, in summary, what we can see is the provisions in ACTA do affect individuals. The criminal provisions, the statutory damages, the ISP safe harbour provisions will affect consumers. They will have a significant impact on intermediaries if they all go through. And there will be an impact on legitimate businesses, generic pharmaceuticals, people who sail a bit too close to the wind in trademark. And so, and it's only by looking at the detail that you can tell just how much of an impact there will be. There is no more compelling argument for transparency than what we've seen here. Okay, so, responses. There are problems of scope, there are problems of substance, there are serious problems of detail of the leaked texts. So what should we be doing today? One thing I just want to highlight is that I think in making arguments against ACTA, or certain provisions of ACTA, we need to think not only in terms of the bad stuff, the cost to individuals, the stuff that I've been highlighting so far. Partly because to date it's been hard to get consumers out there in the general public to get too concerned about this. Michael's given some great examples of activism that is getting a bit of interest, that is getting some traction. But, you know, that's not... I don't think that's going to get us over the line. I don't think even Facebook groups are going to get us over the line. I think we also need to think about the other arguments that you can make against ACTA. And I think part of that argument is to point out that the changes being proposed are no win. They actually don't benefit anyone. They don't benefit consumers. We know that. But I think in many, many of these cases, you can argue that they won't put a single extra cent in the coffers of IP owners. Take the expansion of criminal liability. The idea here is to extend criminal liability for copyright infringement to, say, a few private acts, you know, things that might happen in the home, single willful infringements for financial gain. How many of these are ever going to get prosecuted? No one's going to get sued for making a single copy of something. They're really not. People get sued when they make hundreds of copies of things and sell them in the markets. I doubt that IP owners could point to a single case where reproduction of a single item was criminally prosecuted. Distribution, yes. Making the copy, I doubt it. And if it's not going to get prosecuted, then it's not much of a deterrent. So it's not going to actually reduce infringement because no one actually thinks they're going to get prosecuted for it. It's not reducing infringement. It's not increasing profits. It's just putting more and more scary provisions in the Act. Or statutory, and I can tell you, sorry, I can tell you that expanding the criminal provisions does extremely little. In 2006, as I said, we significantly expanded criminal liability in Australia for copyright infringement, including a whole lot of strict liability offences. Has this led to a wave of prosecutions and a reduction in infringement? No. In fact, we created a whole system of, you know, infringement notices, kind of like parking fines for copyright infringement that could be handed out instantly by police. The guidelines for implementing these are still in draft 4 years later. It's not going to reduce infringement. These things aren't used. Statutory damages. You would think this would benefit the coffers of copyright and trademark owners. Bigger damages awards, more money. Not necessarily. For one thing, if ACTA includes statutory damages, it won't include numbers. It will include a requirement of statutory damages. So governments could introduce fairly low levels of statutory damages, perhaps with caps. If you look at Singapore, actually, they have statutory damages. They signed an FTA with the United States, after all. And the figures are much, much, much lower than the figures in the US. And in Australia, copyright owners already can get six-figure awards against counterfeiters because we have additional damages. This is a punitive damages system. So they have, copyright owners have, all the effective tools they need in Australia to punish counterfeiters. Statutory damages won't give them anything more. So it's not going to put more money in their coffers, I don't believe. And I don't have time, but you can go through most of the proposed provisions in ACTA, most of the scary ones, and you can make the same argument. Very few of them would lead to any kind of increase in profits or reduced infringement for IP owners. And if that's true, then what are we doing? Isn't this meant to be about, you know, protecting creativity so that they can make more money and do more creativity? And if that's not what's going to happen, then what are we doing? So this is you know, this is another argument you can raise against ACTA provisions. Not just, oh, it's really scary and it's going to have bad effects on civil liberties, that's important, but also that it's not going to have any benefit whatsoever. And then there's the question of, what would an actual anti-counterfeiting agreement look like? Well, I mean, we're not here to draft their agreement for them, right? But there are some obvious things you could do that would make this look a little bit more, the text that we have, a little bit more like an anti-counterfeiting agreement. You could remove some of the obviously substantive provisions, things that just shouldn't be there in the first place. Anti-circumvention, secondary liability, injunctions against third parties. You could remove provisions that extend liability to acts likely to be done by individuals and legitimate businesses. Remove the extensions to criminal provisions. Remove the extensions on customs to ordinary trademark or patent, because these are most likely to affect legitimate businesses. You could qualify the injunctions provisions so they're not a new limit on policy. You could introduce more protections for consumers, users, and defendants. And we've got some great models here. If you look at page 35 of the paper I wrote, you'll see I've listed all these TRIPS provisions that are there to protect defendants and users and consumers from abuse of enforcement provisions. Just seeing those in ACTA would be a benefit. Protecting privacy, putting in privacy and confidentiality protections as a general provision would be helpful. Making all of the remedies subject to ordinary procedural protections that our courts use would be helpful. Sanctions against misuse of the measures, procedures, remedies, and, you know, against threats of criminal sanction. So that people can't go around overclaiming copyright or overclaiming patent and threatening people with taking away their house over a bit of file sharing. Definitely no new institutions with new mandates. If we're here to protect against counterfeiting, there's already a World Customs Union and there's already a WIPO. We've got all the institutions we need. And there perhaps should be more of a focus on, you know, customs, the health and safety aspects that Michael mentioned and that seem to not have made their way into the text at all. And maybe we would have to tolerate some information sharing between customs, even if, you know, it starts to look a little scary and privacy invasive. If that is the thing that enables countering counterfeiting, without coming down on everyone else, then maybe a compromise can be made. So that's a few ideas of mine. I hope they're helpful. I look forward to the rest of the discussion today, and thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Kim.